It is Friday, August 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Myanmar's minority Rohingya Muslims mark 1 year since they began fleeing to Bangladesh to escape a military crackdown. U.S. Senator John McCain ends his treatment for cancer. And country singer Loretta Lynn releases a new single produced by her daughter. It's all ahead. Saturday marks the one-year anniversary of the security crackdown in Rakhine State in western Myanmar, also known as Burma, that sparked a mass exodus of Rohingya Muslims to Bangladesh, with reports suggesting that the flight continues. An estimated 700,000 are in temporary housing and relief camps in southern Bangladesh. Yet another 600,000 are believed to be still in Myanmar. Their plight has been likened to ethnic cleansing by the UN and U.S. Myanmar has reached a repatriation agreement with Bangladesh, but conditions are such that the Rohingya are too frightened to return. On Tuesday, Myanmar State Councillor and de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi said Myanmar is ready to welcome back the returnees, but they have to be sent back by Bangladesh. Meanwhile, the UN Children's Agency has warned of a lost generation of Rohingya children. Simon Ingram is a spokesman.
Because it isn't just the 500,000 or so children on the Bangladeshi side of the border, but it's also those who are still left behind in Rakhine State, whose access to education is patchy at best and highly limited. So we really are talking about a whole generation of Rohingya children whose education, whose hopes of learning the basic skills that they need to make a success of their lives, to achieve anything in their lives and contribute to their community's future, is in jeopardy.
Monique Skidmore is a professor and deputy vice chancellor at the University of Tasmania in Australia. She tells International Edition's Victor Beattie, 1 year after security forces reportedly responded to a series of militant attacks by going on a rampage of killing, torture and rape and burning of entire villages, there are no signs of compromise or change.
So at the moment we have 500,000 children in camps in Bangladesh, 360,000 children in Northeast Rakhine State, no access to international agencies or monitors. We have Aung San Suu Kyi in Singapore giving a lecture, reviewing her first 2 years of being in power in Myanmar, refusing to use the name of the Rohingya, talking about the generals in the cabinet as rather sweet individuals, and talking about the security terrorist challenge that they faced in Rakhine State, and saying that unilaterally she cannot repatriate the Rohingya, but this really depends upon a joint effort with Bangladesh. So that leaves this generation of children traumatized with no security, no citizenship, and no repatriation so far.
One report from Reuters suggests that the refugee flow out of Myanmar into Bangladesh continues even today.
It appears that the Rohingya exodus occurs across most borders, not just the Bangladesh borders. There doesn't seem to be any interest by the government in repatriating the Rohingya in Rakhine State. And as Aung San Suu Kyi mentioned in her speech in Singapore, that they had mapped out some areas for the Rohingya to go to. But that, of course, is not going to make anyone go back to a situation in which the military refuses to accept accountability and in which Aung San Suu Kyi seems unwilling or perhaps unable to do anything to try and guarantee the security of any Rohingya who remain in Rakhine State.
You mentioned the children. The UN Children's Agency on Thursday warned of what it described as a lost generation of Muslim Rohingya children to a lack of education, to disease and floods.
And I think they are trying at the moment to increase the amount of education in the camps in Bangladesh to include up to 14-year-old children. So that would be an increase to try and do something to provide basic numeracy and literacy for a generation of children who have had such limited access to education when they're in Burma and very little, if any, access in the preceding year.
likening it to Indonesia, I spoke to one analyst who suggested that the international community, which is sanctioning members of the military, are pressing Myanmar to change too quickly, that it's going to take time like it is doing in Indonesia, where it's taken decades to return to civilian rule.
I suppose it's a question as to whether you believe that the prevalent attitudes towards the Rohingya are simply going to evaporate over time. What we're seeing, especially on places like platforms like Facebook, is awful hate speech, nationalist rhetoric, Buddhist fundamentalist rhetoric, and very little interest in changing that. So there have even been thoughts that the increase of social media platforms would bring a new openness to the country, and yet it's acting as a source to channel and intensify these long-held racist beliefs against the Rohingya. So I'm not sure that we can say that we're seeing any changes yet to openness and transparency, to any decrease in racism. And certainly there's been no move that I can see to change the constitution to remove the generals, and that is the major obstacle to ongoing democracy in Burma.
Monique Skidmore said among the casualties of this humanitarian crisis is the global reputation of Nobel laureate and democracy advocate Aung San Suu Kyi. She said it has deservedly been forever tarnished, with many awards given to her being rescinded as a result of her silence on what she calls such terrible, systematic human rights atrocities that were perpetuated by the military. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The Taliban accuses the U.S. of airstrikes against fighters battling Islamic State. A new Australian prime minister pledges stability. Hurricane Lane weakens but still pummels the Hawaiian Islands with heavy rains. And Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte is threatening to resign. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A British scientist says he found evidence that a volcanic eruption may have led to Napoleon Bonaparte's crushing defeat at Waterloo on June 18, 1815. Historians say heavy rains fell on Napoleon's troops the night before the big battle, causing the ground to become very muddy and soggy. With these miserable conditions, Napoleon's artillery and soldiers wound up getting stuck in the mud, forcing him to delay the start of the battle. This gave his enemies enough time to regroup and develop a battle plan that defeated one of the most brilliant military leaders in history. Matthew Genge from Imperial College London says that electrified volcanic ash from the devastating eruption of Indonesia's Mount Tambora just 2 months earlier had short-circuited the ionosphere, resulting in the cloud formation that dumped the soaking rains on Napoleon. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, in Paris, Riverside booksellers seek UNESCO status to preserve an ancient trade. The family of U.S. Senator John McCain has announced he's discontinuing medical treatment for terminal brain cancer. The family made the announcement Friday, saying McCain had surpassed expectations for his survival since making his cancer diagnosis public last year. McCain has been undergoing treatment for aggressive glioblastoma since July 2017. Despite two unsuccessful campaigns for the presidency in 2000 and 2008, McCain is one of the most prominent lawmakers in Washington. A Republican, he's worked with Democrats as well as members of his own party on such issues as climate change, immigration reform, and campaign finance reform. It's high tourist season in Paris, where the banks of the Seine River are a top attraction and a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Now the city's riverside booksellers are campaigning for special recognition by the United Nations Cultural Agency. At stake, some say, is sheer survival. Kindles and online booksellers are eroding their profits, and tourist memorabilia are diluting their centuries-old trade. But the UNESCO bid is controversial, even among its bouquinistes, as they're known. Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from the French capital.
Parisians are a rare sight in August, but there are a few year-round residents. The city's iconic riverside booksellers, or bouquinistes, are here rain or shine, summer or winter. Sophie Leleux comes from a family of booksellers.
For me, it's freedom above all, not having a boss, working when I feel like it. I have a small but loyal clientele, a lot are travelers, which isn't the same as tourists.
Bouquinistes have been around for centuries.
We've never sold new books, but we don't sell really old books. We've always sold cartoons to make Parisians laugh. Stamps, coins, old paper, this and that.
But today, bouquinistes face competition, partly from the internet. Old engravings and editions of Victor Hugo and Émile Zola are losing ground to souvenirs. Some, like Leleux, are on a campaign to be placed on UNESCO's intangible cultural heritage list.
There's an urgency to defend this trade. Every year, every month counts.
Mayor Berthoud is among those supporting the UNESCO bid. Her fifth arrondissement is in the city's Latin Quarter. It includes the Pantheon, where some of France's greatest writers are buried, and the Sorbonne, one of the world's first universities.
What forged the identity of this part of Paris is books, writing, knowledge. And the bouquinistes along the Seine, especially on the left bank, contributed to the identity and the force of the Latin Quarter.
The bouquinistes must first make the French cultural heritage list before trying for UNESCO status. Even this first step is difficult.
Most candidates take 3 or 4 years or longer. Some take a very long time to prepare their application.
Like Parisians, many tourists consider bouquinistes part of the city's cultural landscape.
Love to be able to bring my grandkids and bring, you know, other family members back, and it'd be a shame if they weren't here. They're part of the fabric of what makes Paris special.
But some bouquinistes, like Francis Robert, fear UNESCO status may mean they won't be able to sell souvenirs, which Robert says helps them survive.
I've always strongly supported books. Bouquinistes must continue to exist, but we have to adapt and diversify.
It's hard to imagine bouquinistes disappearing from the city. The question may not be whether they will survive, but how they will adapt to changing times. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Experts are warning that we will see a resurgence of AIDS unless governments and communities stay committed to ending the epidemic. As VOA's Carol Pearson reports, the virus is still spreading and continues to threaten all of us.
The face of AIDS has changed over the past 3 decades. It's now impossible to tell who has the disease and who doesn't. Treatment has come a long way, allowing people infected with what was once a death sentence to live normal, productive lives. Even those at risk of getting the virus can now take medication called PrEP, or pre-exposure prophylaxis, to stay HIV-free. Dr. Chris Byrer says it's just the latest weapon in the growing medical arsenal against AIDS.
It's the most powerful new tool in prevention we've had in a generation of research. And what we're seeing is that if you combine treatment, so people living with the virus getting treated, and then people at risk having access to PrEP, you really can get control of HIV epidemic.
Yet AIDS claimed the lives of nearly 1 million people last year. And experts predict 100 million people will have been infected with the HIV virus by 2030. The reasons: complacency, reduced funding for AIDS research and treatment, and the difficulty of reaching people at risk. Another major problem, says Dr. Deborah Birx, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator, is flagging government interest.
When we talk to ministers of finance, they always say to me, I thought HIV was over because I don't see anybody dying.
New AIDS infections are down from nearly 3.5 million a year, but remain stuck at just below 2 million. J. Stephen Morrison at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says there are currently 17 million people living with HIV who cannot be reached. Men who have sex with men, IV drug users, sex workers and their clients, and transgender people.
Those key populations and young women account for over 50% of new infections, and they are really hard to reach.
Morrison, Burks, and Byrer discuss the challenges in ending AIDS at a program in Washington to evaluate the messages from the International AIDS Conference in July. Byrer said the warning came through loud and clear.
And it is much too early to declare victory, and the risks of a resurgent epidemic are real.
The National Institutes of Health announced an international program to find ways to reduce the social stigma associated with AIDS. Domestically, the health agency found the highest number of untreated AIDS infections among the poor and in the Black and Hispanic communities. The agency says closing these treatment gaps is critical to ending AIDS in the U.S. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
After her stroke in May 2017, Loretta Lynn is back and releasing new music. Nikki Strong of VOA 1 is here with the latest. Nikki, tell us about this new album.
It's called Wouldn't It Be Great? It's due out September 28th. It was produced by her daughter, Patsy Lynn Russell, and Johnny Cash's son.
Oh,
John
that's
Carter Cash, yes. So, and it's done at the Cash Cabin Studios in Henderson, Tennessee. I think this is the third album out of five in a series that's supposed to be done there. It's a compilation of 13 songs, some new tracks, some fan favorites, all written or co-written by Loretta Lynn. Her marriage, as you know, and the ups and downs in it, has always been a source of inspiration for her music. And the title track, which she just released as a single, is no different. It's a remake from her 1985 album, Just a Woman. I think she also did it with Dolly Parton and Tammy Wynette for their 1993 album, Honky Tonk Angels. It's the final song that she wrote for her late husband, Oliver Lynn, a.k.a. Doolittle, which, as you know, she married when she was 15.
Yeah.
They were together for 50 years, and alcoholism played a heavy role in their very turbulent marriage. And so this song was inspired by her husband's love of drinking. I want to share some of the lyrics because she's such a great songwriter. She's so, like, unapologetic. And it just says, wouldn't it be fine if you could say you love me just one time with a sober mind? Wouldn't that be fine? Now, wouldn't that be fine? Wouldn't it be great if you could love me first and let the bottle wait? Now, wouldn't that be great? Now, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great? Hey, hey, wouldn't that be great? Throw the old glass crutch away and watch it break.
Wow.
Yeah. She's awesome.
How has Loretta been doing since her stroke last year?
Well, she's doing much better now, and she's actually excited. As you know, she was forced to cancel all of her tour dates at the time of her stroke in May of last year, and this album was supposed to drop in August of last year, but it was put off until 2018. But then in January, she fell and broke her hip. Yeah, so that was another medical setback. So she spent about a year focusing on her health, and she says, and this is a quote, she says, it's been a tough year.
Yeah.
She says, but I'm feeling good and looking forward to the album coming out. So she's ready now, and we are too.
One other thing I just wanted to bring up, you said this album is produced by her daughter, Patsy.
Yes.
And Patsy is named after Loretta's late friend,
yes, Patsy Cline.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Loretta Lynn's album, Wouldn't It Be Great, is available now for pre-order and will hit stores September 28th. You can also hear Loretta's music on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. Nikki can be reached on Facebook and Twitter at VOA 1 The Hits. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Wouldn't it be great if you could love me first and let the bottle wait? Now wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great? Hey, hey, wouldn't that be great? Throw the old glass crutch away and watch it break. Wouldn't it be great? Hey, hey, wouldn't that be great? Lord, it's for our sake. Now wouldn't that be great?
The music of Loretta Lynn. And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The first steps are being taken to establish a Space Force as the sixth branch of the American Armed Services. The ultimate objective, said Vice President Mike Pence in a recent speech at the Pentagon, is to create a new branch of our military that is separate from and equal to the five other branches. For many years, nations from Russia and China to North Korea and Iran have pursued weapons to jam, blind, and disable U.S. navigation and communication satellites via electronic attacks from the ground. But recently, these adversaries have been working to bring new weapons of war into space itself. In 2007, China launched a missile that tracked and destroyed one of its own satellites, a demonstration of China's growing capability to militarize space. Russia has been designing an airborne laser to disrupt our space-based systems, and it claims to be developing missiles that can be launched from an aircraft mid-flight to destroy American satellites. Both China and Russia have been conducting highly sophisticated on-orbit activities that could enable them to maneuver their satellites. China and Russia are also aggressively working to incorporate anti-satellite attacks into their warfighting doctrines. As their actions make clear, our adversaries have transformed space into a warfighting domain already, declared Vice President Pence. America will always seek peace in space as on the earth. But history proves that peace only comes through strength. And in the realm of outer space, the United States Space Force will be that strength in the years ahead. Not all nations share our commitment to freedom, to private property, and the rule of law. So, as we continue to carry American leadership in space, so also will we carry America's commitment to freedom into this new frontier. As in other domains, the United States will continue to work with allies and partners in space to enhance the safety, security, and sustainability of outer space for all countries.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.